I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. New polls out today show that voters are most concerned about the economy and energy. But events seem to indicate that race has suddenly jumped front and center in the presidential election. This morning, Barack Obama was interrupted at a town hall meeting in Florida by three young African-American men holding up a sign that read, "What about the black community?" Obama supporters drowned them out with the chant, "Yes, we can." But in the question period that followed, the hecklers were given a microphone, and they said that Obama didn't speak out about issues affecting the black community, such as predatory lending and police violence against blacks. Here's part of Obama's response.
Hold on. Don't start, shouting back. I'm just answering your question. On each of these issues, I have spoken out. Now, I may not have spoken out the way you would have wanted me to speak out.
Well, as blacks accused Obama of skirting race, yesterday Republican John McCain accused Obama of playing the race card because in a stump speech, Obama said McCain and President Bush were going to try to scare voters by saying he doesn't look like other presidents on dollar bills, implying by saying he's black. The Obama campaign says Obama wasn't referring to McCain directly, but to opponents in general, but the McCain campaign rejected that. Meanwhile, new polls show Obama's lead over McCain dwindling in key states. Joining us is David Gergen, director of Harvard University's Center for Public Leadership and former White House advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. And David, do you think this all means that race has moved front and center, perhaps for good, in the general election?
Well, it's always been heavily in the background, hasn't it? Well, I don't think anybody can mistake the fact that the first time you have an African-American as a nominee for a party, race, and race being so central to this country's history, that race is going to be injected to the campaign. This is the first time it's been so openly discussed since the Reverend Wright affair.
Right. Well, McCain spoke today to the National Urban League, and he said he will not make race an issue. He rebuked that Cincinnati radio host who warmed up a McCain rally by chanting Barack Hussein Obama.
Well, he may not personally think he's doing that, but a lot of his supporters on blog sites and some on talk radio are certainly whipping this up and using Barack Obama's middle name to tell people he's a Muslim and painting him as being someone who's out of the mainstream, someone unlike you. There's a very definite intention here that's clear to do to Obama what they did to John Kerry.
First of all, Obama push back against those people, the radio hosts, or does he become John Kerry, who's widely seen as not having responded early enough?
Well, I think he's got to be forceful in what he does. I also think he has to choose a good vice presidential candidate, but more on that in a moment. But I think Obama went technically too far yesterday in saying the McCain campaign has played, is essentially injecting race. The McCain campaign hasn't directly done this. It's been a subtext.
Well, and does McCain have a problem that he can't control those radio voices? Many of them don't like him.
I think you've got to put out the message. If you're a candidate, here's what I expect of people who support it for me. And, until you do that, you have a certain amount of complicity in what's going on. And, we all know that race is playing an issue in this campaign. And I will tell you, there are black leaders who felt that last week when John McCain started talking about affirmative action, said he was against affirmative action, he was against all those quotas and things like that, that was raising a race issue.
Well, you said something last night that surprised me. You said the conventional wisdom may be that Hillary Clinton is out of the race for VP.
Yes.
But that, in your mind, isn't true. In a minute we have, tell us why.
Well, I think here's why. It was Hillary Clinton a long time ago predicted that the Republican attack machine would gear up against Barack Obama, and here it is. And she made what I think is the right argument, and that is that she has had a lot of experience dealing with these kind of attacks and knows how to stand up to it. And I think under the circumstances that it's time for the Obama team, if they want to win, to reconsider the possibility of Hillary Clinton being the running mate. I say that for a couple of reasons. One is Barack Obama's had two or three of the best weeks we've ever seen any presidential candidate ever have, with his trip overseas and then
his lead has dwindled. Yep.
Yeah, and the Gallup tracking poll this week, he started out 9 points ahead, and as of yesterday, he was 1 point ahead. Mm-hmm. So there's been a slippage. So something is going on Now, we don't know quite what that is, whether people are deciding he's too arrogant or whether McCain's attacks are working or whatever it is. But something is going on. And so you look at the who gives the most help to Barack Obama. There's a Fox News poll out from about a week ago that Lanny Davis pointed out yesterday in a Wall Street Journal poll that shows if you put McCain versus Obama head-to-head, just alone, Obama's ahead by 1 point.
Well, David,
if it's Obama and Hillary Clinton versus McCain and Romney, Obama moves up to a 9-point lead. In other words, he has an 8-point pickup with that. So, you've got a situation where it looks as if she might give him big help. Secondly, in a fight, if this is going to be a knife fight, and there are a lot of indications it will be during the fall. She's a great fighter. We saw that during the primaries.
Analyst David Gergen, always with a provocative thought. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Well, the sky was blue today in Beijing, a welcome break from the city's typically gray skies, and news because the Olympic Games get underway in 1 week and pollution is a big concern. This Summer Olympics are China's coming out party. Remember, the country was once so closed, but by the mid-70s, things started to change. The Cultural Revolution, Mao's war against intellectuals ended, universities reopened, books no longer burned. In 1980, John Pomfret became one of the first American exchange students in China. He attended Nanjing University and later returned as a reporter. Well, in his book, Chinese Lessons, Pomfret tells the stories of five of his classmates, how they're faring in China today and what they endured to get there. In this scene, Pomfret describes how his roommate Joe, then a child, joined in a line in the midst of the Cultural Revolution that punished a woman who'd been deemed too rich.
Thwack, thwack. The line moved forward. Thwack, thwack. It inched forward again. Joe reached the front of the line. A middle-aged woman, blood seeping from her nose and ears, faced him on her knees. He pulled back his right hand and, as the others ahead of him had done, smacked the left side of her face. Thwack. Then slapped her again with his left hand. Thwack. The sweat from her cheeks stung his skin. One of Joe's cousins died of starvation during that time. Another newborn cousin was abandoned in swaddling clothes at the doorstep of the Communist Party Committee and never seen again. Joe and his family survived on weeds, seeds, and the runny gruel served at the communal canteen. Whenever they sat down to eat, Joe recalled later, he would cry at the sight of the paltry meal before him. The bodies of the malnourished swelled with fluids. People told stories of cannibalism. Nationwide, more than 30 million people died of starvation.
In light of the upcoming Olympics, we want to revisit our conversation with journalist John Pomfret. We spoke with him in 2006 and asked him to describe how his other classmates fared during the Cultural Revolution.
One of my classmates' parents were murdered by a band of Red Guards. Other classmates basically were not allowed to go to grade school. Other classmates' parents were thrown into the gulag. And then on the opposite side, some of my classmates, like Joe, were involved in beating people and in struggling, even their parents. Joe himself interrogated his mother. Basically, Mao wanted to destroy the fundamental unit of Chinese civilization, which was the family, and not just bonds between parents and children, but also bonds between people and their ancestors. In order to try to break that bond between this world and the netherworld, in order to make everyone loyal to the chairman himself.
So who were these young people when you met them in college? Describe that situation. 1980, was it?
Yeah.
What did you find when you got there?
Well, the age range of my fellow students was really vast. We had a kid who was 17 years old, and we had people who were 35. The fellow who was up above me was 35 years old.
Is this the fellow who was there sort of to spy on you?
Old Chu, yes.
What was his title?
Well, he was the party secretary of the students majoring in history at Nanjing University, class of 1982. And his job, obviously, was to bring other people into the party, but his job was also to sleep on top of the foreigner to make sure the foreigner didn't do anything wayward, and I was the foreigner.
Right. And why were you there, John Pomfret? It's hard for people now to know how astonishing it was that foreigners were going to China, a country that had been closed for four decades. You say you felt like a zoo animal, people staring at you.
A lot of the time it was. I mean, people would surround me and gape at me wordlessly until I would speak. And then they would say, not you can speak Chinese, but basically you can speak. That's the expression they would use in Chinese. I wanted to go there. I mean, we normalized relations with China in 1979. I'd begun studying Chinese history, had the opportunity to go. And for me, it was a way to, you know, get out of America and literally go to a place that was as far away from any experience I'd had in America as could possibly be imagined.
But what was it like as an educational adventure? Because part of what Mao's campaign was turning people on what were perceived as the elite, and that included teachers, professors, educators. Books had been burned and buried. So what, suddenly we're back to education in China. What was it like?
Well, by the time I went to China, which was in 1980, and then obviously studied until 82, the country was just beginning to reawaken from this very, very difficult period where books were burned and educators were thrown into pigsties. And they were coming back, and new books were being published, old books were being published again. Among my classmates, the most popular book was Gone with the Wind. It was extremely popular, and so popular it was also actually quite valuable. And classmates would do a 24-hour shift with the book. Some kids got the shift from 3 a.m. to 5 a.m. and were often late to class because of that, but they couldn't tear themselves away because Gone with the Wind sort of, it's romantic, Southern nostalgia really much appealed to them about a society that is changing irrevocably and a society that has been lost. And they love that nostalgia and that romanticism, and it was a very, very popular. But that, of course, during the Cultural Revolution was considered propaganda. It was considered pornography.
I'm going to move us ahead through time because you tell such incredible stories of different turns in time. You leave school, you become a journalist, a war correspondent, you travel the world, you go back, you cover Tiananmen Square and the uprising there. You find your fellow students to find out what had happened to them when suddenly, further whiplash, the country that now under Mao thought that money was dirty now has a new proclamation, which is to get rich is glorious.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the social changes, the changes in basically in basic values were so mind-boggling to me as an observer, but to them who'd lived through this thing, it was even more incredible. And one of the great things I was curious about was how did they cope with this? And I found actually that they coped with it extraordinarily well in a way. In one way, they didn't really deal with it because they felt, in many cases, spiritually empty. But another way, they really had embraced the culture of the big screen TV and the, you know, the plushy leather couch.
Oh, it's in just a several years.
Yeah, literally. I mean, they have compressed history in China. I mean, they've taken 200 years of our development and squeezed it down to about 25 years.
Well, let's talk about Zhou, for instance. Who we meet at the outset of your book. He's telling you the story of, as an 11-year-old, being a member of the Red Guard and beating up and abusing teachers, professors. Then he goes to college with you. And then he becomes an entrepreneur working with urine.
Yeah, well, there's no shortage of urine in China. For many years, the main form of sort of defecation and urination were in public toilets. And so there was a large supply of it, a localized supply that he could access.
To do what with?
He then refined it, extracted an enzyme, and that enzyme has been turned into a pharmaceutical product called urokinase, which helps break down blood clots after heart attacks. And so he began to set up these urine collection centers all over the country. Basically, armies of young men with strong bodies, riding bicycles with a bamboo slat on the back, and on the top of that slat they would fit all these vats of urine. So if the thing tipped over, it was a real problem. But other than that, he made a lot of money.
John Pomfret on the Chinese students he met in 1980. We're going to have much more after a break. And we began today speaking about political rumors. Well, what is it about our brains that makes those false rumors stick? We'll have that later as well. Back in a minute, here and now. It's just days to go to the Summer Olympics of 8-0-8-0-8. And with that in mind, we're revisiting a conversation with reporter John Pomfret, who was among the first group of American students to study in China after the Cultural Revolution. Pomfret was at Nanjing University in 1980. He describes the lives of several of the people he met there in his book, Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates and the Story of the New China. And before the break, we were talking about Joe, a classmate who made a lot of money after college, collecting urine, which was then refined to make a life-saving drug. So I asked John to explain what Joe's story tells us about China's new economy.
Yeah, in a way, that whole urine economy is a window. I mean, in America, we talk about the China price, which is the Chinese factories producing more at cheaper. And he himself is confronting that as well, I mean, the cutthroat competition among his competitors, the fact that he would have to buy off government officials in order to get access for these urine supplies. The fact that his men were often beaten up by other teams of competitors. I mean, this type of cutthroat, what the Chinese call man-eat-man, not dog-eat-dog, but man-eat-man capitalism, something he confronted and I learned about just by listening to his stories.
Well, in reading that, I wondered if it just was as simple as the template that had been laid down during the Cultural Revolution of people snitching on each other, people being profoundly jealous of each other. You call it the red eye disease, yes. They do in China. Yes. That template now being laid over entrepreneurship and the economy.
Yeah, there's a real sense in China that their capitalist system, because you can't call it a communist system, it's a capitalist system, does not have any of the mitigating factors that we have in the States, which is somewhat of a Judeo-Christian ethic. We have labor unions, we have religious organizations, we have charities, we have NGOs. They can all mitigate the influences of hard-nosed capitalism.
Or try.
But in China, you have none of that. You just have really social Darwinistic survival of the fittest type of a society, which is very exhilarating if you're on the top. But it's really difficult if you're making $2 a day.
Tell us some of the other things you came to see being the effect of China having this huge engine of economy. How is it impacting, for instance, kids?
Well, the interesting thing with kids is that the competition to get into university right now is so intense. I mean, when my classmates were studying for school, I mean, a lot of these guys didn't go to high school or even grade school.
Because of the Cultural Revolution.
The Cultural Revolution shuttered all the schools, and so they were basically sent down to the countryside, and they had to dig ditches for 10 years. But then they got the opportunity to study, they crammed, they tested in. But now their kids, the competition is so intense, their kids are staying up to 1 a.m., 2 a.m. Every night to study to get into that university exam. And these kids are 15, 16-year-old. They don't do any phys ed, and their social skills are also somewhat, you could say, backward or not really well developed, because basically they spend all the time memorizing. And they look at their classmates not so much as potential friends but as potential competitors, which is a completely different view that we have in the States.
Right. You say that while there may be this new fierce economic engine, these new economic freedoms haven't replaced old fears. There's just sort of a restless unease. That the Chinese have a word for it?
Yeah, the Chinese word is fuzao. It's this restless energy. I mean, you could say that the template for China 40 years ago, 30 years ago was fear. I don't think that fear is there anymore. People aren't afraid of the government. People have a lot more personal freedom than they used to. But instead of sort of a satisfaction with what they have, there is always this concern with keeping up with the Joneses. Will my kid be able to get ahead? And it's very, very anxious. And also, will something really change? Because the interesting thing in China is you have this liberalizing economic system, but then you have a political system which hasn't changed significantly in the last 25 years. And so that tension is felt by every person. And often the simplest disagreements can result in massive protests. Not massive, but we're talking, a couple thousand people, just by something that, in other countries could be solved with, for example, a court case or whatever. Mm. But Chinese don't have that ability to deal with their issues like that.
John Pomfret's book is called Chinese Lessons, 5 Classmates and the Story of the New China, tracing classmates from Nanjing University in the class of 1982, which he attended, to today. Quick last question, because I think it exemplifies, in a nutshell, the story that you tell. It's the incredible range of the life of your own wife. You met her on a trek with friends in China. She's Harvard-educated. She'd returned to China to run this trekking company. And as you write, the Communist Revolution drenched her family in blood. Her great-grandfathers and uncles were executed because they owned land. Her father witnessed a family eating its own child during the Great Famine. Her mother became so depressed, she drank insecticide and committed suicide right in front of her. You're wincing. I mean, it's a terrible story. So poor, they only owned a flashlight, I think it was. This girl went to Harvard? I mean, what a whiplash.
Yeah, I mean, she's amazing. So, but I'm not objective. But but she's not. I mean, she's very rare, but also there's lots of other people like her. And my classmates are like her. They've dealt with this difficulty by kind of picking themselves up and moving on. And it's remarkable, the spirit of the people. And so in a way, my book is a testimony to the spirit of these people, that despite all the curveballs that life has thrown them, they still sort of get up and swing again and continue going on. And so, I mean, that's the one thing that has amazed me about this country is that it was down for so long, and then Deng Xiaoping gave them the opportunity slowly over the course of the last 20 years for people to become the agents of their own fate. And they never had that chance before. And arguably not even before 1949 did they have that chance before. And now they've become agents of their own fate. And you see people finally actualizing themselves in the most amazing of ways. So from a personal experience, my wife is totally extraordinary. But looking at it more broadly, there's many people like her. Many people like her who've had these difficulties and just said, forget it, I keep on going.
It's John Pomfret, former Beijing bureau chief of the Washington Post. He's now editor of that paper's Outlook section. All right, still ahead today, a music-drenched love letter from New Hampshire to country stars like Johnny Horton, Loretta Lynn, and Merle Haggard. That's after the news, here and now. According to a Newsweek poll, over a quarter of all Americans believe that Barack Obama was born a Muslim. His website says he wasn't. 12% believe that he is a Muslim, even though, in fact, he isn't. He is a Christian. Here's a clip from CNN reporter Gary Tuchman talking to people in Copper Hill, Tennessee, yesterday about Obama.
I feel he was raised a Muslim the first part of his life. Yes, I've read that he has attended a Muslim school for a couple of years. His father was Muslim, and
see, he says although his father was born Muslim, he didn't attend a Muslim school, and he wasn't raised a Muslim. That he was always a Christian.
Well, if that's true, I'm not aware of it.
Of the roughly two dozen people we talked with, only one man unequivocally believed Barack Obama on this issue.
How does it make you feel, all these rumors that are circulating about him?
I just ask people, where do you get this information from? And people are telling me, the internet, emails, what people say, and I say, do you have proof? No.
Why do we think things we've heard are true when they're not? Well, it has to do with how brains work. It's something called source amnesia. According to scientist Sam Wong, research in neuroscience shows that when we first get information, we park it in our hippocampus. But we then, over time, move it over to the cerebral cortex. And in that process, forget what the source of the information was. We remember the information, but not whether or not it's true. Sam Wong is the co-author of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. He's also an associate professor of molecular biology and neuroscience at Princeton University and joins us from the studios there. Dr. Wong, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Source amnesia. You write that source amnesia stems from the way we gather and stockpile memories. So let's start with that. Tell us how we do that.
Psychologists have known about this kind of thing for decades, and they've called it the sleeper effect. So, for example, it's possible to hear information that's not credible, and you may realize at first that it's not credible, but over time, you might forget that it's not credible, and you might just remember, well, I heard someplace that Al Gore is prone to lying.
Which, by the way, we rush to say, we've not heard that.
But certainly these kinds of ideas get repeated, and then you forget that you've perhaps heard it from a source that you don't consider credible, whether it be a particular cable news source or some other kind of source that you think might be suspect. So if you see someone on your television saying something about Barack Obama's religion, you start thinking about that, and it sticks.
Well, that makes sense in many cases, but aren't there people who want to hold on to misinformation? You talk about a Stanford study of students. They grabbed onto the evidence that supported their initial position. So isn't a part of this not just the brain forgetting the source, but a part of us psychologically not wanting to admit that the source might be shady?
That's very much the case. We tend to assimilate information that fits with existing worldviews. So, for instance, if we have a particular point of view about politics, or in that case of the Stanford study about the death penalty, we are more prone to accept evidence that agrees with that worldview. And in that study, students were presented with two pieces of evidence about capital punishment, one agreeing with their position and one opposed to their position. And all the students tended to accept the study that agreed with their own position.
Well, you mentioned the rumors about Barack Obama. They reportedly stem from a press release written in 2004 by a web columnist and former Obama political opponent named Andy Martin. Since then, of course, it's just grown viral-like on the web. Now, the Obama campaign, they've gone on the offensive. But what are your thoughts about that?
That's interesting. They've set up a site called Fight the Smears, in which they're trying to debunk these false statements and replace them with truths. And it's not bad. I think it's really good that they have rapid response. And I think, in general, politicians can learn from this strategy that they've taken. However, one problem that that site currently has is that it tends to repeat the false statement.
So even if you're debunking a rumor, you're reinforcing it?
Yes, a little bit. It gets repeated every time.
Tell us about the Coke as paint thinner study.
Oh, that's an interesting one. A group of Stanford students was repeatedly exposed to an unsubstantiated claim that the researchers took from a website. And the claim is Coca-Cola is an effective paint thinner. And they read this statement 5 times. By the time they were done, they were asked to attribute it to some source, and they were 1/3 more likely to attribute it to Consumer Reports than to the National Enquirer, despite the fact that they had not seen it in either source. And so they retrospectively gave it credibility after hearing it a number of times.
Right. Again, we may forget what a source was. We may not even know a source, and we sort of make it up.
That's right.
Well, you know, we're vaguely aware that repeating rumors reinforces them. But, you know, what do reporters do? Because we constantly hear from listeners who say, why are you even bringing that up? You're only reinforcing it even by refuting a rumor. So how do we report on rumors? If in fact, they're impacting a campaign, let's say.
Well, that's difficult because journalists, of course, reporters have the job of putting a story in at least enough context that you understand the story. So it's very hard to avoid doing that. One thing that one can do when covering these stories is present something compelling that's a storyline that's true.
So in other words, instead of saying over and over Barack Obama is being falsely portrayed as a Muslim, their campaign, for instance, might say Barack Obama is a Christian, reinforcing
yes.
the Christian.
Hmm. Or one could tell the story about how he was pretty secular until his late 20s, came to religion, and now is a committed Christian. That's kind of an interesting story.
Can you just talk for a minute about the way emails further rumor mongering? It happened to John McCain in 2000 when Bush backers said that McCain had fathered a black child. The truth is that McCain had adopted a Bangladeshi child. I don't want to start that rumor again. But how do these internet rumors take hold, aside from our brains forgetting original sources of information?
Of course, rumors of false paternity and illegitimate paternity have been going on for a long time. But with email, there's a fine art to these now. So email propaganda messages typically have several key elements. One is a few real facts to fool people into believing that the source is credible. And then there's a gut-wrenching appeal, which appeals to emotions, because strong emotional cues make a statement more memorable. And then the lie, which is carefully inserted in the middle of all this, and then the whole thing is repeated. And those components, some amount of credibility, a gut-wrenching appeal, and repetition, tend to make something viral that then spreads.
And your brain forgets where it came from and just retains the information.
Your brain loves the emotional appeal, forgets the source, and there it is, stuck in your head.
But you also write that studies show that you can sort of, maybe not reverse that tendency of our brains, but you can at least slow it down for a moment. Tell us about that.
There are ways to combat this tendency to accept statements and assimilate them. A strategy that can be used to filter these pieces of information that we receive is known as considering the opposite. Taking a piece of information, and when you initially hear it, pause and think about how you would react if the information were in some way opposite to the way it is told to you. So, for instance, if you hear this rumor about Barack Obama's religion, stop and say, is the information I have more consistent with the idea that he's a Muslim or with him being a Christian? And if you stop and think about it for a moment, you will often more critically evaluate the evidence and come to a more accurate interpretation of the information you're given.
Sam Wong joined us from the studio at Princeton University, where he teaches neuroscience and molecular biology. He's published over 40 articles on the brain and is co-author of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. And we have to ask you before you go, why do you lose your car keys but never forget how to drive?
Well, your brain has about 6 different memory systems, and this one that we've been talking about for facts is a system that tends to decline pretty early in life, starting at the age of 30. But skills like driving a car are more deeply stored in your brain in a somewhat different system and stick around longer.
Thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, and just to remind you, you can listen to our show stream live at our website or download a podcast at here-now.org. And to remind you again, you're listening to Here and Now. Let's drop a quarter in the jukebox.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Johnny Cash provided the soundtrack of Dana Jennings' childhood, along with Hank Williams and Tammy Wynette and the other giants from the golden age of country music. Their records played on the gray and white Sylvania record player Dana's parents bought at Custo Supermarket in Hampstead, New Hampshire, right after they got married in the fall of 1957. 8 days after that wedding, Dana arrived. Born into a dirt-poor world of tar paper shacks, the seduction of freight trains, backwoods relatives he likened to the monster Grendel in Beowulf, tempered by the music, always a music. Dana Jennings writes about the music and its connection to his New Hampshire childhood in the new book, Sing Me Back Home, Love, Death, and Country Music. And he joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thanks a lot. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, here we are in Boston. Let's take care of this whole New Hampshire thing first. Because when people out west, you know, think New Hampshire, they're thinking New England leaves, you know, primaries, independent streak, but they may not be thinking Johnny Cash. So what are they missing?
New Hampshire was a lot different, you know, in the 1950s and 1960s. My hometown of Kingston only had 900 people back then. It was a dairy farming town that had more cows than people. And I really grew up among a bunch of poor working class people who really had a lot more in common with people, living in Appalachia than they did even living in the center of our town.
Yeah, you're right. You came of age in a rogue extension of Appalachia. And just for an example, your dad worked in a paint factory that you describe as an above-ground coal mine. Your Grammy Jennings, just like Patsy Cline, knew what it was like to go walking after midnight searching for her man. Your playboy uncle actually said things like, "Hey, good looking," when he went out. I mean, these were people out of the records, but real.
They were real country characters. And when I look back at them now, it just seems as if they stepped straight off the vinyl of all those great country songs from the 50s and 60s.
Your maternal grandparents broke up decades later, met again at a bingo game and started dating. That's a song in itself.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to talk about the work, because it really jumps off the page. You worked in the paint factory when you got older, along with your dad. It would be declared a toxic superfund down the road. I mean, tell us about that backbreaking work your father did.
Yeah, it was a factory called Kingston Steel Drum. And what we did there was we reconditioned 55-gallon steel drums that came in full of paints and solvents and insecticides and drums that just had skulls and crossbones on them. And we had no idea what was in there. And it's probably one of the most valuable parts of my education. Working with my dad and working with these men where they're so desperate to make a good hourly wage that they would decide to work at this place that they knew it was poisoning them. And we all understood the factory was also poisoning my town.
You paint this incredible scene of your dad coming home at the end of a work day and your mom caressing him, I think is the word you use, with magnets to pull stuff out of his nostrils and ears, you know, the steel and stuff. Give us a song. Give us a country song to go with that working man that you grew up with.
Well, I think, you know, one song that springs to mind is Another Day, Another Dollar by Wynn Stewart. The guy who narrates the song knows that the work he's doing is, you know, it's killing him physically and spiritually, but he also understands that, you know, in a very old-fashioned way, that because he's the man of the family, he's the one who has to bear the brunt of the economic reality of their situation. You know, each day he drags himself out of bed and goes to work at some hellacious factory.
This is Wynn Stewart.
Another day, another dollar. Daylight comes, I'm on the way. Another day, another dollar. Working my whole life away.
That's Wynn Stewart singing Another Day, Another Dollar. We're talking with Dana Jennings, author of Sing Me Back Home, Love, Death, and Country Music. We'll have more in 1 minute, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
I'm a honky-tonk man, and I can't seem to stop.
I love to give the girls a whirl to the music of an old jukebox. But when my money's all gone, I'm on the telephone hollering, hey, hey, mama, can your daddy come home?
There were plenty of honky-tonk men in Dana Jennings' family, hard-working, hard-drinking men. There were wife-beaters, child-beaters, as he writes, men who created their own solitary confinement, living a gritty existence in Kingston, New Hampshire in the 1950s and 60s. Dana Jennings reaches back to the classic country music of that period, for instance, this Johnny Horton hit, in his new book, Sing Me Back Home, Love, Death, and Country Music. And Dana, you write that songs like Johnny Horton's Honky Tonk Man really tell a secret history of rural working-class Americans in the 20th century.
Because the best singers and songwriters came out of, you know, really hard, poverty-stricken backgrounds, you know, mostly depression backgrounds, they were telling the stories of their lives and the people around them, and those stories really resonated with rural working-class people nationwide, not just in the South, as, you know, a lot of people perceive country music. And we're fortunate that we have this oral history that we can hum along to that's left from the 50s and 60s and into the 70s.
You say that one of those songs, those old good songs, let you become again the person who loved that song and let you enter the lives of the now gone members of your family. You mm-hmm. give an example. Here's Webb Pierce's There Stands the Glass. Let's listen.
There stands the glass that will ease all my pain, that will settle my brain. It's my first one to take.
Danny, you say this song takes you back to your late Uncle Lloyd. Tell us why.
He was one of the many alcoholics in my family. And, you know, when he was a young man and the whiskey and the beer hadn't ruined him yet, you know, he would dress up on a Saturday night and, you know, he'd wear his black Western shirt with the fancy stitches, and he'd wear his black jeans and, you know, pile his hair as high as he could using Brill cream. And even at that age, he understood the booze wasn't any good for him. And when he listened to someone like Webb Pierce, you know, Webb was holding up a mirror to him as, you know, of his life. You know, he'd be looking in the mirror getting ready for Saturday night, and then he'd have the record player on and he'd be listening to Webb Pierce. Mm.
Let's talk about the women in your family and country music in their lives. And let's listen to a little of, continuing the theme, Loretta Lynn's Don't Come Home A-Drinkin' With Lovin' On Your Mind.
Well, you thought I'd be waiting up when you came home last night. You'd been out with all the boys and you ended up half tied. But liquor and love, they just don't mix. Leave the bottle or me behind. And don't come home a-drinking with loving on your mind.
It was a male-dominated world, and for the woman I grew up among, to hear someone like Loretta Lynn, who really wasn't that different from who they were. You know, if Loretta hadn't become a country music star, you know, she could be sitting at the kitchen table having a, you know, having a cup of tea with any of them. And to hear her in a really feisty way draw the line in the bedroom at 4 a.m, it was significant for those women. And it told them that they didn't always have to cave in to what their men wanted.
You write that Loretta Lynn might have been a woman sitting in the kitchen having a cup of tea. You write about your mom spending your fourth grade school year basically at home with her while she sat at the kitchen table sipping her tea, staring out the window. What happened?
She got married when she was 17 and had me right away. And I think by the time 1966 rolled around, she was, you know, she's 26 years old. She had 3 children. She didn't have a driver's license. You know, my dad was working a couple of jobs. You know, money was very tight. And I think she was simply overwhelmed. You know, looking back, the reason she kept me home was that she needed someone there to keep her company. It was probably a good thing that I was there in a lot of ways.
Well, one of the ways is that after eating your lunch of Campbell's soup and tuna fish sandwiches, you'd listen to Patsy Cline. And when you put her in that context, you know, it's not a, she's not a cliche. Yeah, let's, mm-hmm. let's listen.
Away from me, dreams that just won't.
little more about that, Dana Jennings. For instance, we hear Patsy Cline there, and, you know, people can think, oh, I have heard that song, but you hear it anew, you know, with a story like your mom's. Or we began by listening to Johnny Cash, I Walk the Line. These are songs that have become such standards that people, you know, they're wallpaper to some people.
Right.
But you hear them with a real ferociousness underneath.
I really felt that no one had listened really, really hard to the music. You know, it had really, you know, to use the academic term, to treat those songs as serious texts. And, you know, I wanted to hear them fresh again. And when I was writing the book, I'd put on one of those songs and I would just, you know, I'd listen to it over and over, you know, scribbling in my notebook as I sat there in my den.
Well, and the title of the resulting book comes from the Merle Haggard song, Sing Me Back Home. It sounds like that's what you're talking about, is that music does take you home.
It reconnects me to the Kingston that doesn't exist anymore. It reconnects me to all of my old relatives who are dead. The songs translate me back to the past. And they also give me something, one, that I can share with my parents, but also it's been really important to me to share this music with my sons. It provides a really important bridge for them to understand my parents and their great grandparents before that.
Let him sing me back home for the song I used to hear. Make my come alive, take me away and turn back the years. Sing me back home before I die.
Well, there's only one modern day song in your book. It's by Iris DeMent and it's called Mama's Opry. You know, how does it fit in with the songs of the 50s and 60s?
She's one of those singers. The quality I hear in her voice really goes back to the origins of commercial country music. You know, I hear Jimmy Rogers in there, and I hear the Carter family in there. And, you know, I hear the twang in there like Hank Williams and Loretta Lynn. And this song, Mama's Opry, literally the first 7 times I heard the song, it made me cry. And, you know, there's a line in there where she's talking about her mother. You know, she grew up plain and simple in a farming town.
She grew up plain and simple in a farming town. Her daddy played the fiddle and used to do the calling when they had hold down.
That describes my mother. It just always kills me when I hear that song.
Dana Jennings' new book, Sing Me Back Home, Love, Death, and Country Music. Dana, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thanks a lot.
The Carters and Jimmy Rogers played her favorite songs. And on Saturday nights there was a radio show and she would sing along. And I'll never forget her face when she revealed to me that she dreamed about singing at the Grand Old Opry.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again, Here and Now.
While she was hanging the clothes on the line, I was a kid just humming along.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.